and it's nearly so new that the ink might smudge if you're not careful, but it's quite fresh off the press, and we will be using that from week to week, except for this first talk. I've got material that's introductory and not in the book particularly, except latently. So we'll just not need to worry about that until the next session. But basically, that will be what we'll be going through. And if you find it helpful to read on, you might already have had a look at it, but if you find it helpful, you might like to read it one week ahead, and that will aid in the whole familiarity process. Obviously, there'll be more to do than just read it through when we come here. So that's the material. And just to give you a bit of an idea how that's all going to work out, I'm going to talk, first of all, in this first session about hope, or more than that, really, but certainly talk about coming to this subject with hope. Secondly, in the latter session this morning, we'll talk about what it means that our children are children of covenant, or that we are people of covenant. Then next week, we'll be talking about authority, the real troublesome one. The next week, we'll be talking about forgiveness in the home, that also could turn out to be just as troublesome, but also incredibly delightful. So that's forgiveness. And then the next week, about wisdom. And in the final week, the fifth week, I want us to talk about ways we can teach our children and also the church and its children. A couple of quite practical matters that I think would be important. And that latter material of the fifth week isn't in the book either. That is, except latently. So that's roughly the way that we're actually going. Now, of course, also as we go along, I'm hoping that we'll be able to have time, given that I'm a good boy, to actually have some questions and so forth, and also comments. When we've taken this course previously in other places, it's been found helpful to have times of question, which all manner of comment and practical thoughts bring up new aspects to the subject that have been very useful. So I think we'll do that as well. Yes, roughly then, that's the way that we'll proceed. A little bit later on, I'd like to introduce you to a book or two across on the table that would be quite useful to be having a look at as well. All right, let's come to the introduction then, and say that, first of all, the purpose of God and so of the whole world is to be familial, that is, to be family-oriented. If it's true, if it's just true that God is a father, and I'm looking around at you, and I know most of you, and I know that you believe these things anyway, but if it's true that God is a father, and if it's true that the Father has created something, and if it's true that when God chose to make this world, he made it through a son, can you appreciate that we are living in what is essentially a family business? It couldn't be otherwise, could it? If a father makes something, and if a father makes something through a son, and not only so makes it through a son, but brings it to its goal through a son, then you can be sure that we would never understand what our world is about. We would struggle and fret, and we would bring up all kinds of models to try and work out what it was about, and we would always miscue it because it is essentially a family business. So it's not just an accident we're born into families, as though God couldn't find any other way to get us off the ground and into the human race. We're born into families because that is his nature, to be familial, to be a father. So everything he creates is that way. And we wouldn't be prepared for life unless, in fact, we were born into families. Not only so, but we are not prepared for life unless we have acted honourably in those homes. Can you see immediately why the first commandment that relates to the way that humans treat humans says, honour your mother and father, that it may go well with you all the days of your life in the land that the Lord your God gives you. In other words, how could things go well unless we'd actually honoured our mother? And that's the linchpin in one sense. It's the bottom line, I should say the foundational principle of all of our society, social life, that we honour our mother and father. So it's not just that that's where we start off, but that commandment is in operation until we die, because it says as long as you live, not as long as your parents live, but as long as you live yourself. In other words, I will never be able to stop honouring my mother and father, because as soon as the minute I do, I will be disqualifying myself from being able to grow in maturity to understand this life and live in it. So familial loyalty and faithfulness and wise dealing is a matter of great significance, because God is a creator. We're talking specifically then about Christian parents and their children, Not because we don't think that things we say couldn't help people that aren't Christians, but simply because it's the only kind of parenting we know anything about. And when I say it's the only kind of parenting we know anything about, we can read all kinds of books written by people other than Christians, in fact quite decidedly other than Christian, and we might even pick up some useful things from them. But we wouldn't know whether they're right or not, do you see? Now, for example, if you're bringing up your children as a Jew, then I understand there's certain things that are very important if you're bringing up your child as a Jew. They've got their particular model. If you're bringing up your child as an Aboriginal, then there's certain things that are very important because they've all got their models, do you see that? But all of them are just culturally bound. But here we're trying to come back to something which is from God the Father about all of life. So if we find out what a Christian family is intended to be, then obviously we would have found out what the Creator thinks about life, and that have something to say to all cultures, obviously. So it's the only thing we can speak about with certainty. So this is my definition of parenting, which is in the book, but so you can check that up later. Our definition of parenting is representing God's fathering to our children. That is, we don't have to initiate anything. We don't have to find a model for anything. All we have to do is to be subject to the Father's parenting as he fathers us. And then because we are being fathered by the Father, we understand what its dynamics are. We're living in the dynamics of it and are secured by it. And so we faithfully represent that to our children. Now, as I see it, that is not just part of what parenting is about. That is the whole of parenting. There isn't anything else to do but that. So that is the first thing. That is our definition of parenting. It's representing God's fathering to our children. Hence, the purpose of parenting must be preparing the next generation for living in what is essentially the Father's world and tutoring them to live in his purposes. Now, that also has ramifications for what the church is, because the Bible says that the people we want to look after the church are people who are managing their own households well. Now, why would you want people who are managing or ruling their own households well? Why would you want that kind of person to be leaders in the church? Because the church is not like a family. The church is a family. And in fact, the only family there'll be in the end will be his family. So our families are penultimate. That is, they're not the ultimate. And in fact, if we thought they were, we'd have an idolatry on our hands, wouldn't we? So our families are with a view to his family, and that's the way that Jesus actually played it. Right from the beginning, it's the way that he played it. Do you remember that the first disciples were actually invited to come and live at Jesus' home? Where do you live? Asked the first disciples. Jesus said, come and see. The next story we have about the disciples is that a family wedding was being conducted, and Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. I can imagine the person making up the guest list. And they said, oh, if we ask Mary and Joseph, and not Joseph, he's thought to be dead by now, but if we ask Mary and her son Jesus, we've got all those guys we've got to have as well. Can you imagine the guest list? That's a little bit of conjecture there, but can you appreciate that in fact Jesus began with his disciples in his actual home? And later on, when the family, that is Jesus' mother and his brothers, were getting a little bit worried about Jesus' overwork routine, they went, and particularly because stories were getting around that he was overworked and that he was beside himself and perhaps off his rocker or something, the family solicitously came down to try and rescue him. And Jesus looked around at those that were listening to the word of God and said, who are my mother and my brothers? But those that do the will of God, hear the word of God and do it. Can you see how Jesus was never disrespectful to his own family? Never. But that family he understood was with a view to the family of which he would be the elder brother. And so that's the way that the church is. And we'll never understand the church apart from that. We'll never be able to properly lead the church unless we first have people who in fact have managed their own households well. When I was working with students in tertiary campuses, I used to teach the students because I was responsible for their leadership of their groups on campus. And so I used to teach them that the people we want to actually lead the campus groups on the campus were people who were making a fair go of being sons and daughters at home. Because if they weren't doing, can you see that's adapting the principle for that? And I think I could say that I've seen enough to know that the people who made reliable leaders were people not who had good homes, not people who had perfect parents, but people who were being honourable in regard to the parents they had. That was where they learned to have the resources, not just to be peer group pleasers, to be fancy entertainers, but in fact just to lead in the home. So the principle applies to the world, it applies to the church. So we say then that it's the gospel that will nerve us for life, and we'll say plenty about the gospel in these 5 weeks. I don't know how to talk about anything apart from the gospel. No apologies for that. It's the gospel that nerves us for life. If there isn't a Father in the heaven who loves us, if there isn't a Son of God who's represented that Father to us so we know what he's like, well, none of us are going to go anywhere. But given that we know that, the place where we practice it is in our homes. And that's, do you see, the gospel needs to come to home, as we may say, and it needs to be fleshed out there, because it's there we often sort of say, well, if I know all these wonderful Christian things, how is it that I can't live like that in the world? How come I lose my cool so quickly? Do you see why God's put us into homes where the whole matter of the truth that he's given to us can be just worked out day after day, stumbling day after stumbling day, until gradually those qualities of that God wants to work in us are worked out. They're not meant to be worked out in business. They're not meant to be worked out in the church, although, frankly, that happens as well. But they are meant primarily to be worked out at home. So it's the gospel that nerves us for life, but it's the family where it's rehearsed as a way of life. Now, how long does it take to learn to count 10 before you jump? As we say, you know what you should do at home? Count 10 before you do something. Well, it takes a long time, doesn't it? So God's put us in homes so that there we can work it all through. So that's the first thing. We live in a family world because it's been made by a creator, and that helps us to understand a lot of things. Secondly, let's put away any idea that only good families are useful. Let's just put it right out of our mind that it's only good families that are useful. It's the what is which is the crucible of our life, not what ought to be. And you say, you might be saying to yourself, well, if I could get my family up to a certain level, then it would start to be a useful family. And that's not on at all. The Lord has always, right from Adam onwards, worked with what is. Do you see, he's never started with something that ought to be. He's always started with what is. So do you see, nobody had to sort of feel like they're going to get their family up to a certain level or something or other like this. Today's where we actually are, so that's where we start. I think you can, I'm not sure about define, but I think you can describe what authority is by saying that authority begins by accepting responsibility for what is. Just imagine that as a politician, for example. Accepting responsibility for what is, not for what ought to be. Now, I know that that's so because that's precisely what Jesus Christ did. When he came into this world, he was this world's Messiah. What did he accept responsibility for? Not for making the world the way it ought to be. He accepted responsibility for the way the world was, and it cost him his life. Do you see, I hope that point has been hammered home, because I think it needs to be hammered home, that God has never started with what ought to be. God is quite happy to come into any home, be it run by a drunk and a prostitute, and said, well, that's the home you've got. So that's that. So learn to be honourable there. And never what ought to be. So the what is the crucible of our life. And if we break that crucible, you remember a crucible is something that holds molten metals. And so if you take the imagery, if you break that crucible, that is, if you despise that crucible and break it, you'll start a fire rather than make a useful product, if I can follow the analogy. You see, the home, right, your home as it is today, with all of its wrinkles and with all of its turmoil, is the home that God wants us to be thinking about, because that's the one he's working in, that's the one he wants us to honour, etc. Despise that and you create fires as the molten metal just runs all over the place. And we're seeing that happen, aren't we? Because the home's become a little bit difficult, somehow or another we think we've got a licence to break it and so forth. Just viewed to talk with a friend recently, and for us both to say, in the context of our marriages, that it had never occurred to us in the slightest, never occurred to us in the slightest, that our marriages should break up. That is, we have struggled as husbands and wives in order just to work out what it means to be a husband, what it is to be a wife. But the idea that somehow or another we should sort of make over and start all over again, never even entered our heads at all. In other words, this is the home. God's given us husband, wife. So that's it. See, just stay together. That's it. And you work it out from there, not apart from that, as though there was any alternative. Now, this is not about marriage, although, but you can't really talk about families without you talk about marriages. But can you see, if we just say, no, let's never despise the what is of our family. That's where God has put us, so let's work within that. And let's make a metal that's precious. Let's not break it open and start fires. So we honour our mother and father all the days of our life. We honour our whole family situation. Just lovely to know some people who I actually know, whose parents are not far different from the kind I caricatured a moment ago, a drunkard and a slut and a prostitute. And to actually see those children honouring their mother and their father. Can you see that? That it is the way that it is. So we just start with what God has given us and work within that. Now, the third thing. So we've said that the world is familial. We've said that God starts with what we've got. Thirdly now, where are we starting from personally? Regardless of our particular situations with regard to our children, age-wise or responsiveness, I trust that we will come to this course with hope. Or even if we've come with a sense of despair about our family life, that we're at least prepared to change from despair to hope as we go through this particular course. Because that is with the preparedness to change from the despair to hope, and so actually enjoy our parenting. I actually remember there's a verse in Nehemiah where it says that the people were listening to the law of God and describing all that it actually involved for them, and they thought, we haven't kept that for decades, for millennia, or for centuries or something. And they were despairing, and Nehemiah said, you're not allowed to weep today. So this is a day of great rejoicing, and the joy of the Lord is your strength. In other words, if you don't enjoy this, you'll never have the head of steam to get up and do it. So can you see that we've got a resolve today that either to be people of hope or to be prepared to change from despair to hope in regard to our families, in regard to our being mothers and fathers, or children in regard to our parents, because we're still that as well, so that we've just got that head of steam to actually get in and do it. One of the things that you actually learn about children is that they love games. And it's probably true to say that games are incredibly important and enjoyment is incredibly important for children. As somebody's observed, the end of our life is going to be spent in incredible, unparalleled joys, sporting in the presence of our Father. And I don't think that's a wrong description of heaven. I'm sure heaven's going to involve work, but I tell you what, it's going to be fun too, isn't it? Now we expect to have to be gambling with unrestricted, unalloyed joy before our Father in the end day. Isn't it right that somehow or another children should be tutored in what it means to gamble before their parents and to have fun and to enjoy life? Can you see that if we ourselves are not coming at our parenting with an incredible amount of hope, which would then spill over into joy, in spite of all the things that go on, that in fact we would be denying our children and ourselves the very head of steam that's going to enable us just to keep going. So I really do hope it's going to be great fun together to learn about what parenting is and the great fun to do it. Otherwise, somehow or another, it's all going to be one more chore, and boy, aren't the kids going to know it. All right. So God picks us up not from where we should be, but from where we are. And our parenting will never be the revelation of our cleverness, but it will be the revelation of his grace, and that's what's going to keep it joyful. Remember, Paul said that all the hard work that he did as an apostle was nothing but the grace of God that was in him. It's 1 Corinthians 15, he says that. So we can come at our parenting with an incredible head of steam, if I can put it that way, and a lot of joy and a lot of hope for the whole thing, not because we think we're going to make a great job of it, but because we've got a great Father whose promises are so great that they can surmount all of our foibles and faults and misappropriations of what he's given us. And so we believe that our family is going to be a great family. No reason why we shouldn't, if in fact God is our Father. All right, let's ask the question now, fourthly, what are little boys and girls made of? Do they, in fact, like the poet said, come trailing clouds of glory behind them? Well, the way some of them get dolled up and the way that we sort of pamper them and so forth when they're little, we'd think maybe that we were just dressing them appropriate to their nature, aren't dear little innocent things. Well, life has a way of teaching us something a little different from that. So let's ask the question, what are they actually made of? Very interesting, you see, that the world has tried to work out what little children are made of. And a couple of ways of looking at it that the world's come up with are either that they're a blank slate, that is, they come into the world neutral, and whatever you write on them is what you get. I understand, I'm not qualified in this area, but I understand that our education and principles are derived from that basic premise that children are a blank slate. It's called a blank slate theory. That is, that children are just there and what you write is what you get. So then if anything's gone wrong with a child, all you've got to do is change what you write on the blackboard and you've got a different product. Can you see that that's the kind of mentality that's behind the educational thing? If anything's going wrong in society, change the educational thing and we'll fix it. Do you see that? Why? Because kids are a blank slate and what you write's what you get. Another theory, and really linked in with that in some strange way, is the fact that children are actually good. And that if they turn out bad, that it's somehow or another because they've been mistreated along the way. But that basically all that children need is to be brought out and to be allowed to come out, and then what's natively good in them will act. So that's the humanistic model, that human beings are good, or at least neutral, and so that we're responsible for letting it come out or for making sure that something good comes out. Well, we certainly believe differently from that, and I really can appreciate why humanists have had to come up with that, because a humanist is a person who said, no God. No practical God with whom we have to relate as far as our life here is concerned, even if we're agnostic and say there may be. So basically, we're it. And somehow or another, we've got to have a way of feeling good about what we've got in our hands here. And so we can't start with the premise that man is evil, because that would be so putting down and despairing, we couldn't cope with it. So let's start with the premise that man is at least neutral or good and move on from there. Now, a Christian, because he accepts the fact that there is a good God in the heavens, doesn't have to look at his life with rose-coloured spectacles, but he can actually see things as they are without becoming a cynic or without becoming despairing. In other words, the thing that gives us our good feeling about what we're about to do is not what we are, but what he is. Can you follow how far from religion being the opiate of the people and religion being the thing that puts rose-coloured spectacles on us, it's the very God of grace and goodness that enables us to see what we really are and to really look at what our children are without losing all hope. So I hope that's clear in our minds, because there's a very big difference between what I'm saying and what the world would say with regard to what children are. So children don't come trailing clouds of glory, but they do become, in the first instance now, let's just look at children as they grow. Children do come to us remarkably dependent and trusting. That's true, isn't it? Remarkably dependent and trusting. And so for that reason, they are very impressionable. You remember Jesus saying that the angels of little children behold the face of their Father in heaven. It's just as if God doesn't even trust children to their parents. He's got an angel specially there as well to look after them. Maybe that's just as well, isn't it? So there's the angels of these children watch before the Father. And Jesus said, just you be careful what you do with those kids, because if you mislead them, he said, they're so impressionable, you can just mislead them just like that. But if you do so, it'll be better for a millstone to be hung around your neck and to be thrown in the depths of the ocean. So there's a confession, isn't there, that children are incredibly impressionable, and therefore the ways in which we actually deal with them, particularly when they're very young, is very, very important. So later, they learn to understand and to speak, and they become tutorable. That's a word, I'm not sure it's a verb. But they become able to be tutored. Hence the importance of having something to teach them that's true, the very things that are the basics of our life. Now, that's just an observation of what children are. They're very impressionable and they are very tutorable. But we learn after a while that they not only can receive impressions and they can not only be taught things as they grow up, but we find out later on that they've also got a will of their own. And sometimes we find it earlier than later that they've got a will of their own. And that's where we discover in particular that they share our fallenness. And I don't care what age you think that it actually becomes apparent. Some of us discover that it's apparent right from very earliest times, as they have a way of, I don't think that children need to study psychology. It's just because we forget so much that psychology ever needed to be invented. They know how to wind us round their finger just like that from very, very young, don't they? Very astute at it. So we find that they've got wills of their own, and it's in that context that we discover that they are fallen creatures the same as ourselves. I don't want to get into the doctrine behind all of that, of what's been come to be known as original sin and all that kind of thing. I think, so one person has said, the doctrine of original sin is the most demonstrable doctrine perhaps in all of Scripture. In other words, it's pretty clear that that's the way that it is. They become increasingly able to express the independence of their own wills, and here's where we most closely are aware of our own fragility, not just our children's, but it's where we become aware of our own fragility. Just talking to a mum very recently, and she became alarmed at the quickness and extent of her own anger in regard to the children's obstinacy and so forth. We become increasingly aware of our own fragility because it means a lot to us to get our own way, doesn't it? It means a lot to get us our own way with our children, and it means a lot to get our own way over and above our children. That is, we still want to do all the things we used to do. So forth. So we realise just how strong-willed we are with regard to our children and how upset we become when our little bark is rocked and so forth. And not only so do we become aware of the evil in our own hearts and the willfulness of our own hearts, but we also become incredibly aware of the willfulness in our children. That's just before we go on from there. Notice that in talking about the impressionableness and the tutorableness and then the willfulness of our children, we've actually noticed what could... One person has talked about the three stages of growth and so forth. The person involved is the author of this book, Christian Nurture by Horace Bushnell, a book that's well worth having. But he talks about how when children are come, they're very impressionable. And he's got a particular theory, and it's one that's been supported by much observation. This is an old book, but it's been supported by a lot of observation. He says that between 0 and 3, you've probably taught your child, you've influenced your child, brought to bear that... Well, you've taught your child about half of what you'll ever teach them. And he wants to emphasise in saying that, he's very guarded about saying that he really thinks you can actually measure that. He's not really interested in that, but he rather wanted to convey something, and it was this, that you may think that the time when you can really do something for your children is when you can start talking to them. But he observes that, in fact, before children know the meaning of the word love, they have to have been loved. Before they can understand the meaning of strength of character, they have to experience strength of character. Can you follow that? So the impressions they receive, they look at you with this adoring face, just so briefly sometimes, the wide open eyes and just look at you. It's quite rude, actually, but just go on looking at you and learning incredible things and receiving. They won't even remember it later, but the impressions they're receiving are just going down so deeply. So it's a very impressionable age. And so let's not despise, and I say that to... make any of us despair, saying, it's too late for that now, so I can only work on 50% from here on in. We've had to say God always, but always, begins with what is. And so, nonetheless, we want to say that so that if we have that opportunity, either as parents or as grandparents or as uncles or as friends, and we see these children 0 to 3, let's not despise what is being communicated in the age of impressions. And then the age of tutoring, where we can actually reason with them. And again, we see their wide open eyes now as we tell them that mummy is this or daddy is that and the policeman's for this and the so-and-so's for that. And we say, yes. And then they repeat it back to us, the mummy's for this, daddy's for this and so forth. And they can be tutored in beautiful ways. But it's, as we said, they also have wills of their own. And I'm not really sure that comes when they're 11 or 12. Again, Bushnell suggests to us that, in fact, the early years are when they are completely subject to the will of their parents. I've never quite seen the baby that's completely subject to the will of its parents. But anyway, it's a nice idea. But I guess in all practicality, we do become increasingly aware of the fact that our children have wills of their own and that it's less and less possible to, in fact, shape those wills. Well, that's just an observation, not that we can make very much of that. So that's what are little girls and boys made of? Impressions, tutoring, not what they're made of, but what are they made of so as that they are, we're saying they're impressionable, we're saying they're tutorable, we're saying they're also very willful. And we've got to deal with all of those things as they come. And in the process, we discover not only their fallenness, but we also discover our own fallenness in the family. Next thing then, can we deal with our children? What hope do we have? I mean, if we said we're going to come to this with hope, we've got to have some grounds for it. So do we really believe we can deal with our children? Now, I think the fact of the matter is that many parents have actually come to the conclusion that you can't. For example, if a parent says, oh, you can't tell children these days, they have abdicated. Exactly, haven't they? And we've got to call it what it is. I don't care if you've done it. I don't care if I've done it. I don't care if we've experienced it, and we all have. That is, you feel that you can't tell kids these days. But if we ever believe that lie, we have abdicated. Because the question is, can we deal with our children? And the thing is, we've come to the conclusion that, in fact, we can't deal with our children for a couple of reasons. One, they act so obstinately. B, we're such a poor product ourselves, we begin to ask the question after a while, what right have I got to tell them? Do you see, our conscience bears witness to us, we don't have a right to tell them, and therefore we sort of hold back. So, for one reason or another, we may well ask the question, can we actually deal with our children? And the answer has to be an unequivocal no. How could one sinner deal with another sinner? Well, we just can't, can we? I mean, it's just not within us to be able to do so. Do we have the resources to handle sinners? And here's where I just wonder, I don't just wonder, this is the way I see it. I just wonder if God has taken his hand off of our families in Australia to some degree, that we may just realise the incredible unmanageability of our families, but at the same time make us realise that in fact we can't do without families. Just take the testimony of a drug addict on about page 3 of the Advertiser some months ago, where he said, I don't need this kind of special drug rehabilitation course. I don't need this. I don't need this. All I need is a mum and dad who love me. There's just an odd drug addict that'll tell you. We're not going to be able to get away from the fact that as families where it happened, that's what we crave for. That's what we long for. And so we've got the two things. On the one hand, we've got this incredible dearth of family life. But from another point of view, we've got this incredible longing that that's what we have. And has not God given us up to that in order that we may turn from the idolatry which we may well have made of our own family life to him as the true father and say, from Adam onwards, parents have never been able to hand their children because sinners can't handle sinners. But God's been the only one who's ever found a way of dealing with sinners. So God's the only one that's ever going to be able to tell you, A, what to do with your children, and B, give you enough head of steam to do it. So it's most important, isn't it, just at a very practical level, that we be people who turn to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ and learn from him, because he's been the only one that's ever been able to get it together. And we're going to find out, particularly in the second talk today, how that's so. Now, just to make that whole point very clear, let's go right back to the first family, that is to Adam and Eve, and to realise that in their family, with Cain and Abel, they had fratricide within the first generation of children. That is, brother killing brother. Now, that ought to tell us, oughtn't it, that parents of themselves, it doesn't take long for family problems to develop. You would have thought it would have taken 10 generations, perhaps, to get that bad. But once Adam started to criticise Eve, and you know when he started to do that, don't you? The minute he sinned and was confronted by God, he started criticising his wife. The woman you gave me, she, do you know what I mean? And once you've got a woman and a man that are criticising each other, that has ramifications. Just remember one thing that I learned from somebody else about parenting, and that is that the most important thing that parents can do for their children is to love their husband or wife. Say that again. The most important thing that a mother and father can do for their children is to love their husband or wife. I remember one of our children coming up to Chris one time and saying because of the things that were going on at school and so forth, came up and said, Mummy, you're not going to leave Daddy, are you? Means a lot to our kids. that mother loves father, that father loves mother, and where you have criticism in the family between mother and father, as you had between Adam and Eve, then it has all kinds of problems in the family. And so if Cain and Abel are in some way a product of their children, can you see that Adam and Eve would have had to look at Cain when he'd killed Abel? Maybe they'd had a lot of chances previous to that to look at their son as he grew up, to see the increasing anger in him, see the way that he wasn't happy with the cursed earth that God had brought them into, and to see Abel growing up in a different way. I'm not sure that it all happened all just of a sudden when they brought that offering. I'm sure it developed over a period of time. And the parents may well have looked at their two children and noticed the two different ways in which children could grow up in a family and felt unable to do anything about it. So then we have fratricide within the first generation. Note also here that most murders are within families. That is, most murders, I think 70%, isn't it, of murders are conducted within the family context. Can you see what a volatile thing it is, our families? And how if things aren't going well there, do you see how we can't live without family? Because if things don't get well with there, it touches us so deeply, we've got to turn to murder to express the horrible feelings of anger that arise. Murders are within families, and problems would derive from the... and problems would have arisen. That is, when there's been murder in a family, it doesn't just happen because that family had a problem, but because the family before it had a problem. And perhaps the family... Do you see that? These things go on and on. And if things aren't resolved within families, it stirs up in such incredible things. Well, I just want to point that out to show that that family was not just a very ordinary family, that Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, but they were a family in which the dynamics of familyhood, both in a good sense and a bad sense, are very amply demonstrated. And I wanted to make clear in our minds so that what I say next can come through to us. From the beginning, the answer to our sinfulness has been in the woman's seed. Now, many of you here will know that story, but let me just spell it out a little bit. God came to the woman when she had sinned, the man when he'd sinned, and said, because you've sinned, this is what will have to happen. But he also said to the woman, your seed shall bruise the serpent's head, and the serpent's head shall bruise his heel. But he promised to the woman that she would have a child, and that in that child and in that children's children would come that which would bruise the serpent's head. Now, from their very simple understanding, what had caused the problem? A serpent's temptation, right? That was where all the source, and as they grew on in their life and they saw all of the mischievousness of their criticisms of one another, and they saw all of the hostility of Cain for Abel and so forth as they grew up blowing marbles in the dust or whatever else they did, they would have had occasion, not once, but many, many times, to say to ourselves, what hope is there for Cain? For that matter, what hope is there for Abel? And they would have gone back to that one germ of hope which God had given them, and that is that she would have a child, and that through that child, somehow or another, the work of the devil would be undone. Now, do you believe that God has given a promise that will undo the mischievousness of your household? It's very interesting, isn't it, that God promised that that would come not by some angel dropping out of the sky, but through the woman's seed. And so it's quite interesting that when Seth had his first child, it says in the scriptures that men began to call on the name of the Lord. And there, if you like, is one of the early expressions of man's hope. Men began to call on the name of the Lord. Can you see that our sense of hope in this world relates to the fact that we have children? So rather than our children sending us into the pits of despair, the very fact that God permits us to have children and train up the next generation rather should be an incredible sense of hope to us. You following that? What is the seed that came to Eve finally? It was Jesus Christ, wasn't it? But can you see that in the process, a whole generation of people, a whole race of people, I should say, had been developed who looked forward to their seed as being the way in which God was going to work out his promise for humanity. Now, can you see that as Israel learned to look forward to the promised coming seed by whom God would undo all of the mischievousness of the evil one in our community, so we ought to be people who, when we have our children, should say, our God yet has hope for our earth. He's given us the next generation. In that sense, while there's life, there's hope, because the life, not just because it's there and we have to have it, like Woody Allen would say, you've got to have hope, but because God's given that life. And if God gives us life, he must have hope for the generations to come. Do you see how we're not called to dredge up some hope from within ourselves based on an extremely poor performances, but rather we're to look at the God who's made us and say, well, has God got some hope? And has God put some hope into operation? Well, if God's got some hope and God's got some hope into operation and he still gives us children, then we can still have hope. So it's quite interesting in the scriptures to notice the number of times that expressions of hope come in Genesis 1 to 11 when they have children. And I don't know, I remember talking to one father and I asked him, what was the time when you most felt God was with you or something to that effect? And he thought for a little while, and I just realised he's known to somebody here, but sort of from way back, but that's another story. He said, when I watched my first child born. Just wonderful, really, isn't it? To watch a child being born. And well, it may inspire within us incredible hope, because that is God's sign to us that he still believes in the generation to come. He hasn't wiped us out. And he's going to affect his purpose in history. Now, if we can have God's hope, from having God's hope, we'll have find some hope for our families. If we work the other way around and say, well, I'll only have as much hope for the world as I can have for my own family, can you see what despair we're going to be in? Our homes are not the basis of hope. It's God's dealings with humanity that are our basis for hope. And if we've discovered that, then we'll find it. I've learned something by looking at people and looking at leaders on campus groups in particular, and that is, you can ask two people, how's your group going? Because I was responsible for a number of years working with students on campus groups. And I'd ask those students, how are things going? And I'd ask one person, and they'd say, oh, terrible. Only about six people there last week, and the meeting went terribly, and so forth and so on. I'd ask another person who went to the same meeting, how are things going? And they'd say, oh, not bad. There's just six there, but gee, it was a beaut time. And so it was very interesting, and I learned that people have hope for things, and they have, hope for things more in proportion to what's behind their eyeballs than what's in front of their eyeballs. And we might have been looking at our children and we might have been trying to get from our children and get from our families some kind of hope with which to send us into the community. Because it's undoubtedly true, if your family's going well, it gives you a great head of steam to get out to work. It gives you a great head of steam, and contrary-wise, if things are going bad, do you know what I mean? It can be the opposite. But from another point of view, we've got to be people to whom God has given hope, so that when we look at our children, we're not seeing them from the perspective of what they're presenting to us, but we're looking at them not through rose-coloured glasses either, but we're looking at them from the perspective of what God promises in regard to the human race. So God is the one that's given us a future and a hope, and this hope not only includes our children, but actually requires them. See a different view? This hope not only includes our children, it requires them. God has got a purpose that at the end of history, that the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And he hasn't finished it yet, so there's got to be another generation. So he'll need your kids, won't he? Can you follow that? So he's got a hope, and it has to include your children, because he's going to affect that. So our encouragement for our families comes from what God's on about in the community. Now, if we know these things, we'll be delivered from being people of expediency. The world just has to work out what will work. And when they ask the question, what will work, they have to ask it in the terms of the next 5 or 10 years. They can't dare to think any further than 5 or 10 years down the track. If it doesn't work in 5 years, it isn't working. And so we come up with ridiculous suggestions, like one intellectual from Australia who suggests that the way to correct violence on the streets is to remove the sexual limitations from young people. He says because they're all pent up and there's sexual frustrations, therefore they take it out on street signs and sides of buildings and little old ladies. How ridiculous an assumption. But can you see that because he's working in a short time frame of reference, he can only do what's expedient, and he comes out with a model of parenting which is ridiculous. Whereas we are people who believe that what God has said will work in the long term. And so we don't worry if our kids hate us for the next fortnight. We believe they'll get over it. Can you follow that? We must have hope from God, or we'll be delivered up to the limits of expediency and be very, very limited in what we're prepared to do. Let's take a break.